Welcome to the Milt Rosenberg podcast, and somebody called Milt Rosenberg is, in fact, talking right now. My guests are the same group that we featured recently talking about essentially American domestic affairs, politics and culture and our troubles and our potentials. Today we focus on the world and America, to be sure, in the world. Those guests are Chris Roebling, who's a leading person in the city of Chicago, and indeed the state of Illinois, in public affairs from a public relations viewpoint. Indeed, he's a corporate consultant at very high levels, and he's a self-identified conservative, which I think appears pretty clearly if you give him a chance to talk. Charles Lipson is a colleague from the University of Chicago, former chairman of the Department of Political Science, and one of the leading people in political science in the country. Indeed, he's got a new book, Still Aborning, still being written, which relates to the matters that we're going to be discussing tonight. And our third guest joining us on the podcast for the first time is Kitty Kirth, who has a major political consulting and political activist outfit, and you would not resist my designating it as on the left, on the Democratic side of American politics.
Yes, progressive.
But it's an international organization, and that's something related to what we're going to do.
International in what sense?
We work all over the world.
You have clients all over the
yes.
world. I note that Axelrod has just signed on to do work for the House of Commons, isn't
yeah,
that right?
Yeah, well, Ed Miliband, the leader of the Labor
Miliband,
Party.
No less,
yeah.
Yeah. So I guess he's going to make another top official.
We'll see. It'll be very exciting.
Never mind. I must ask. This is pure gossip. As I've identified, Charles is a leading member of the faculty at the University of Chicago, and I was a less leading but long-term member of that faculty until I emeritized a while ago. And since I emeritized, a kid I used to know when he was a Cub political reporter on the Tribune has now established an institute in his own name, namely David Axelrod, planted at the University of Chicago. What's the attitude towards that that new institution?
I think
on the part of faculty.
Let me say that the institute, which is known as the Institute of Politics, has been an almost unqualified success. And I think that faculty tend to be skeptical of anything that comes from outside. That is, they'd like to see things that were generated internally as part of faculty research. David didn't want to do that. In fact, he wanted to create something specifically for undergraduate students outside of their academics to introduce them to the real world of politics. And I am an old friend of David's, and my only question about it from the very outset was that I felt like if this Institute of Politics was a pipeline to the Democratic wing of American politics, it would not be consistent with the goals of the university, which is to allow students to pursue whatever direction they wanted. And I must say that the leadership there started with Darren Reisman, and then now Steve Edwards is the head of it. They have a lot of people. They do a excellent job. There's a woman there named Dylan Sigler, and she has played a role in getting literally hundreds and hundreds of students internships in Washington and in Chicago with both Democrats and Republicans, whatever they prefer. The young Republicans meet there as well as the young Democrats. My only criticism of them has been all the problems, the big problems that the Obama administration has had over the past year have been the focus of almost no meetings at the Institute of Politics. But in that regard, they are no different from the rest of the University of Chicago.
And most of the American press as well.
Right.
I've been to a bunch of their events, and I think part of that is their events are actually more policy-driven than politics-driven, ironically, when it's called Institute of Politics, but it's been more issues and policy.
Now, we are tonight, in this particular hour, going to look at the world and our location in the world, but some of the major problems that agitate and focus the attention of foreign policy experts, both in government and in all the universities and so on. But let me begin that this way. The first great historian might be Herodotus, but properly defined, was probably Thucydides, who really masters a technique which has been handed down over more than 2,500 years virtually. For example, he insists any fact is not a fact until you've got three separate sources to verify it. The old Herodotus didn't play it that way. The great Thucydidean volume on the Peloponnesian...
I thought that was Woodward's rule. Well, I didn't know that Thucydides invented it.
It's a good rule.
Got it from Thucydides.
Okay.
And Thucydides gives us a wonderful formula in the first chapter of his book on the Peloponnesian War when he asks, what are the causes of war? They are Deus, Time, and Ophelia. That is to say... George, I'll deal with my Greek, by the way.
Please.
That is to say, interest. Nations go after things that they can get from other nations, maybe even by attacking them and grabbing stuff. But also fear. Sometimes you enter war, even preemptively, because you fear that the other guy is gaining on you. And this is prudent to attack before you are attacked. And essentially honor.
Honor.
Nations are also interested in honor. Maybe that triad doesn't work quite as well. Maybe you can think of other reasons. But all of those motivations are still surely there. By the way, I should mention as a quick sidebar, those who are listening to us on Ricochet at the moment don't know that on the other website, which is simply miltrosenberg.com, we replay hundreds of programs done originally at WGN Radio. And one is a two-hour conversation. Well, the commercials are taken out, so it's about an hour and a half, with Donald Kagan, who is essentially the leading scholar of the Peloponnesian War in modern guise. He's a former dean at Yale and an old friend of mine, as a matter of fact. And if you want to hear that, just go to miltrosenberg.com tune in. But I come now then to this. What is the state of the world with regard to regression into exchange of blows, to understate the case? Mm-hmm. We've had loads and loads of little wars and loads of outrages which are warlike but involve terrorism. Mm-hmm. This has not been a pacified globe at all, has it, since 1945?
Well, I think that there was a Pax Americana post-1945 against a backdrop of a Cold War in which there were rational actors on both sides, and we actually, in a pretty amazing development in history, created a whole new category of weapons and then did not use them. And so you have to take something from that as encouraging. Despite all of the friendly leftist lunatics who said, we're going to blow ourselves up and, we're out like global warming today. But I think really what you're looking at right now, unfortunately, and maybe it's because of the decline of the influence of the United States of America, which we can chat about. But I believe that there is a world of growing chaos and that there are interests. There is fear. There's not a heck of a lot of honor. And I think we're seeing a unraveling of that 60-year period in which many regional issues were resolved through an expression of, I would say, international sentiment through the tribune of the United States of America.
Charles Lipson was another great political scientist, namely Sam Huntington. Was he prophetic? Correctly prophetic about what was to come after the Cold War was finished.
He spoke of the conflict of civilizations, and I think he defined at least seven civilizations, and I think that he got part of it right and part of it wrong. I think what we have now is a kind of world of peace in the North Atlantic and in parts of Northeast Asia that is among the stable liberal democracies. We want to trade with each other. We believe in a production, not predation. The border with Canada is utterly stable, that sort of thing. The biggest powers in the world, Germany, potentially, France, that sort of thing, have not armed themselves. On the other hand, there are two vast areas of chaos. One is virtually everywhere where Islam touches any other civilization. That's the Huntington point. Although
he says the first great conflict of civilizations to come, it will be between Islam and what he was almost tempted to call Christendom, except Christianity isn't quite as forceful as an organizing institution these days in the West, as Islam is in the East.
That's true, but there's also severe clashes within Islam.
To be
sure.
That
is between Sunni and Shia, but also between more moderate elements and others.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's right. And the other that he pointed to was China. Now, China, it seems to me, the civilizational aspects are not what's leading to the clash. What's leading to the clash is an increasingly nationalist and provocative Chinese foreign policy, which I think is disastrous. Just in the last few days, we've had Chinese ships ramming Vietnamese ships. They're claiming various territory. I've heard, I just think that there's been a reversal of Chinese policy. This is, China has been growing very rapidly. They're now seeking to project their power into the their nearby seas.
Does the Thucydidean Triad make any sense of what China's up to these days?
You know, China, I think, is kind of like a teenager. They've grown to a certain extent. You're absolutely right. You know, on the economic front, they've been booming. They've been making all this money, but they don't quite know how to be a world leader yet. They're immature in some of their development. In Africa, for example, China is invading all over, everywhere in Africa, going in and building roads, but not hiring any local people, not creating any local jobs. So they're creating a lot of animosity within the African states. They want the investment, but they don't like the fact that the Chinese bring workers over with them. So they're not being good neighbors. And I think, you know, the classic Chinese and Japanese clash, the classic Chinese and Korean clash.
Chinese nationalism combined with Japanese nationalism is a very nasty combination.
It is worth remembering what another communist regime did in Africa some while ago. They didn't bring workers. They brought guns and killed people. Little Cuba actually disrupted Africa considerably.
And left the guns. And the guns are still there and being used again and again.
No, I think that China has to be recognized as being in sort of year 40 of its peaceful rise. And it has gotten to a point where, because of governance issues internally, I think that the Politburo and the ruling regime is allocating power a little bit differently, so that nationalists, and not to say militarists, are holding some sway. Now, that's not to say that we shouldn't keep a close eye on China. But the real instabilities with China, I think, are, number one, its ability to absorb peasantry into the cities.
That's absolutely crucial.
That is a declining ability. Relatively speaking, it's still impressive, but it's not as good as it was, say, 10 years ago. The second problem is you have 1 billion people here and no energy. And up here you have all of the energy in the world in Siberia, just north of China, and no people. And so China is fundamentally unstable relative to its energy consumption, right? And I would say number three, in terms of food, China is, of course, a vast importer, and it has a real problem getting to scale to feed its own people, despite all of the lies that were told by the communists for years and years or decades and decades.
There now comes a quiz question. Uh-oh. Who said the following? Do you recognize these ideas and this rhetoric? We need, I'm quoting now, we need to use the United Nations Security Council, and we need to believe that preserving law and order in today's complex and turbulent world is one of the few ways to keep international relations from sliding into chaos. The law is still the law, and we must follow it, whether we like it or not.
Vladimir Putin, New York Times.
Good for you.
Yeah, I mean, who didn't remember that? I mean, that was pretty dramatic when he was lecturing our president after the—
I was going to say Richard Nixon.
So what do you make of—
Nixon never had that level of faith in the United Nations.
Christopher, has he been keeping the law lately in and around
Ukraine? Well, of course not. And you know, I think one of your favorite expressions, which I've heard you use recently, is demography is destiny. And it's not— Putin is not in an adventurous cycle for the glory, although as a Russian leader, he seeks the glory. And, you know, the last guy to take Crimea without firing a shot was Potemkin. So, I mean, he I think, would like to see himself move up to that level. His impetus is demography. His impetus is the decline of the Russian nation, and the problem of the Russian nation writ upon what remains of the Russian state. And I think that he is doing this in many respects to reclaim Russian population so that he can take this next step, which is to increase Russian birth rates.
Aren't there intimations of the Sudetenland crisis years and years ago?
Absolutely.
There were those Germans in a part of Czechoslovakia on the border, and Hitler was able to say, they must be honored, they must be given their rights. You better give us
Sudetenland. Well, I had family
Sudetenland
in the Sudetenland.
What?
I had family in the Sudetenland. Not
then.
Actually? We had gotten out, just as we've gotten out of Ukraine. But I would just say, having talked with Chinese officials about Russia, their contempt for Russia as an economy and as leadership is just, they just sneer. Because what you have is
Russia's a small nation. Russia's a nation with only 150 million people.
Russia has an economy the size of Italy.
Yeah.
And a declining demography. But they look down at it in a different way, too. Like, the Russians aren't very educated.
Well, that's correct.
Wild.
And they're drunk, and they don't have a population, and so forth.
Male longevity runs around 58 years or thereabouts.
Yeah, I mean, that's too long.
I've been out of school for a long time, but I seem to remember something about the Russians always looking for a warm water port.
Yes. Yes. Well, the fact is,
and demography is destiny.
Odessa is a great warm water port.
Exactly.
Right.
My point exactly, Mel.
There was a big debate during the Clinton years about whether NATO should expand and whether the EU should expand into the former countries that were dominated by the Soviet Union. And liberals wanted to expand in order for stabilization, and some of the neocons wanted it to expand because of liberty. A lot of the conventional realists said, no, you'll just create pushback from Russia. One of the things that's so striking to me is how both sides now feel vindicated. Because the people who said we should not expand all now say, see, the Russians felt like Western Europe and the United States pushed right up next to their border, and what you're getting is pushback. The other side says, see, the Russians would have done this anyway. Putin would have done this anyway. If we hadn't extended guarantees to the Baltic states, if we hadn't extended guarantees to Poland, what would happen to those states? So I see this is a very dangerous situation. I actually see the China situation as equally dangerous, and I'll tell you why.
Vis-a-vis
virtually all of its neighbors, Japan and so forth, but particularly in the South China Sea. During the Cold War, when a Russian general, Air Force pilot, or anybody else behaved provocatively, it was a really bad thing for that person's career. You did not want to go off the reservation. In China, it is just the opposite. What you want to ask yourself is, there was a Chinese ship that rammed a Chinese naval vessel, military vessel, that rammed a Vietnamese ship recently. What you want to ask yourself is that Chinese, I don't know whether that was ordered from above or was taken. What you want to ask yourself is, what's going to happen to the guy who was piloting that ship? Does he do well, or is he in trouble? My hunch is that he's doing well, and that portends something really bad.
I think some of this goes back to the Bush administration, and I think it started in the Clinton administration. And the truth is that Northeast Asia is a very treacherous place, and there are – we've not mentioned the Koreans, but the Koreans, and especially the North Koreans, they're a major part of what's going on there. And so we allowed, I think it is fair to say, that we allowed the sort of post-Korean War Northeast Asian security framework essentially to either atrophy or to expire, whatever you want to say. And China,
you're reviving it now.
And we're late to that party, as we've been late to other parties. But China, these militaristic or nationalistic elements within the overall power framework in China, who are being granted some a little bit of lead by the Politburo, are expanding and they are testing limits. And there will be, you know, there's a lot of pride in China, and there is a sense that China has been the leading nation of the world for 5,000 years, and it has been denied its rightful place of leadership.
A question calling for your judgment. Consider the two possible threats to the stability of Western governments and Western nations. There's two possible threats in terms of the countries or the groups from which those threats come. One, China. Two, and we're really going back to Sam Huntington. Two, Islam and certain nations representative, but also the great terrorist organizations which are supranational. Which is the greater threat?
I think the greater threat is what Chris was talking about earlier, and really it's more of a chaos threat. Yes, to some degree it is Islam, but it's these, not only Islam, but extra national groups. You know, terrorist groups of any kind, I think, are going to be the worldwide threat in the next 10 years.
Isn't it worth noting, however, that though they are extra-national, they have strong national sponsorship and backing? Surely Saudi Arabia carries a lot of responsibility there to which we do not hold
truly
them.
Noxious.
To,
truly
and also noxious. And Syria, until it got into the trouble it's in presently. And Iran, obviously, has played a major role in propping up Hezbollah and all other Shiite terrorist organizations.
Well, and especially with Saudi Arabia, I think that's really the one where the global, you know, we've never held Saudi Arabia responsible for their actions or lack of actions.
It was Roosevelt who said of Somoza in Nicaragua 1,000 years ago, he may be a bastard, but he's our bastard. Essentially, Roosevelt also had the thought about King Saud. He may be a bastard, but he's our bastard.
I'll tell you something. That there's been people who've looked into that quote, and my understanding, Milt, is that it's not clear whether or not we said that or whether Somoza made it up in order to show that he had total U.S. backing.
Uh-huh.
But, of course, he did.
And I use versions of that quote all the time, and I didn't know
but
it was about Somoza.
But you use it about
Somoza.
Your husband,
usually, I frequently use it about the mayor, but, you
I
know.
Well, I'll tell you, Milt, though, when you talk about Islam, I want to differentiate two different kinds of threats. One is the threats that come from terrorism and its sponsorship, and now we see more of it in ungoverned spaces like Waziristan and Pakistan and northern Nigeria, but Iran is a state threat. And it's not – when we say Islam, I want to be very clear. It's not that it's – when we use the term, these are groups that are themselves explicitly using their religious doctrine as a justification for their policy. So we're not just saying there's a bad guy and he happens to be Muslim. We're saying there's a bad guy who is using a certain variant of his religious belief as the reason for his terrorism, the reason for his attacking somebody.
And was it possibly not ever thus? Mm-hmm. Consider, as Islam has considered, from so long ago, the Crusades. Was not religion used as a justificatory device for what were essentially geopolitical aspirations?
Is not only religion, but the hatred of religion.
Yeah.
One of the things that I was getting at that I think we really need to be afraid of increasingly in Europe and even here in the U.S. are these hate groups, who I also consider terrorists, the people who are Holocaust deniers, the anti-Semitic groups, the anti-immigrant groups in Europe. And in fact, my favorite thing in an odd way is they really are anti-Semitic because they hate Jews and they hate Arabs. So, you know, they hate everybody.
When I talk to Europeans about that, one of the things that comes out about these far-right groups is how they have been left the entire field because ordinary politicians will not speak out about a lot of genuine concerns. There are parts of Amsterdam women cannot go into because they will be raped. There are parts of single women simply can't go into. There are schools that are essentially no longer being taught by the normal standards of the Netherlands or Denmark or whatever in Northern England. If normal politicians, if the ordinary mm-hmm. politicians won't speak out about that, but those are genuine public concerns, then that field is left to the most extreme elements who are speaking out about genuine public concerns.
Well, and the most in Northern Europe, I know better than the other parts, but the extremist parties have gained parliamentary seats in Norway and in Sweden is by, you know, they also like a lot of their game is really good. It's like, oh, Sweden was so much better, and we just want
Jews
everyone to have jobs.
Jews have been driven out of Malmo, Sweden. You cannot be a Jew and live there in Malmo, Sweden, southern Sweden, a civilized area.
And
you can't be a gay person and walk around. I mean, you're just vulnerable.
The gay part isn't true, but the anti-immigrant part is rising at the same time.
The gay people I talk to in Europe are very concerned about the anti-gay movement by Muslim fundamentalists in Europe.
Yeah, but not in Sweden.
It's definitely the case in Amsterdam.
But
you know, I think what you've got here,
we
talked recently in another program we did about the plague of political correctness, which affects governments, affects political parties, and so on. To paraphrase an old Latinism, possibly what really applies here is that the general standard now in the Western world, in governments, in the press, and so on, is de islami nil nisi bonum. Of Islamics, you can speak only good.
Mm-hmm.
It is not allowed for the ordinary.
This is Ayaan Hirsi Ali is disinvited to Brandeis because she is saying things. Hold on one second.
Right.
She is saying things about Islam.
Of course.
She is speaking as a witness. She's speaking as a victim. She is speaking as a participant. And she is saying things that are very compelling. We have this movie out, The Honor Diaries, which is populated with a very accomplished, very credible, very independent Muslim women.
Mm-hmm.
And they are making statements as witnesses and as in some cases, victims of this continual string of anti-female violence in these countries.
Now, let me make
of all of that, one says nothing if one is
editorial
or academic in the Western world.
So-called student groups at the University of Illinois at Chicago that went out of its way to disinvite that film from its screening. And you have had at the University of Michigan that film was canceled after it was scheduled. And there are some places where Honor Diaries is being actually
shown. Let me tell you something. Let me tell you something about Ayaan Hirsi Ali.
Was she on the show?
She was on the show, not in this studio, but in one of the larger ones a few years ago. As a matter of fact, that discussion, again, a two-hour discussion with commercials whittled away, so it's about an hour and a half, is to be found at our other website, miltrosenberg.com. We put it up, I think, only about a week ago, though it goes back about 4 or 5 years. When she was here, I was so deeply impressed by her courage, by her strength. Also, I was quite taken by her beauty. And I was very impressed by the fact that she was surrounded by bodyguards, some of them supplied by our government. Of course, she was hounded out of the Dutch parliament and out of Holland generally because she is viewed in Islam as an apostate and an apostate who is critical of Islam. But, gee, there are loads of former Christians and even former Jews who are very critical of the religions that they have abandoned, and we don't try to kill them.
I want to say that what Christopher Roebling and Milton Rosenberg have just said would subject them to prosecution in much of Europe.
In Europe?
Yes.
But
you have said things that demean, in the language of some of these prosecutors, a religion. And that is not protected speech. What we have is the erosion of free speech in the guise of political correctness. You could find yourself on trial.
But we have it in this country as well, even if
criminal that's informal, but it's formal.
But this is a bigger threat to the West.
Yeah.
Than a particular al-Qaeda offshoot. I mean, a particular al-Qaeda offshoot might, you know, end up someday killing 1,000. And that would be awful. It would be horrible. And we've got to do everything we can to find those people and blow them up. However, if we cannot stand for liberty and for expression and for involvement and for opinion, if we are going to be a nation that is going to tell the University of Montana that they cannot have any operations unless there is a federal political correctness overseer.
This is true. They've done it.
That has already happened courtesy of the Obama administration, which simply does not care.
Hey, give me opportunity on in direct reaction to what you just said to raise this basic question. And it goes particularly to Chris, who's rather it goes particularly to Charles, the other academic at this table. What's wrong with the American universities? Why have they become so pusillanimous? Why have they become so time-serving? Why have they become so stupid?
Well, I think part of it has to do with Rousseau and the notion of a noble savage.
Right.
I think that there is a romanticism. If you want to go back 40 years, you would say it was the beginning. It began with things like France Fanon and the Wretched of the Earth and the romanticism of the Black Power movement and its violence. And you saw in 1969 with armed people taking over in Cornell when they did that at
Columbia
and Eric Holder was one of the group that actually did it so forth. What you had there was a university that essentially caved in. This happened it's happened on college campuses numerous times. I wrote an editorial. I'm writing a monthly editorial for the Tribune, and my editorial a couple of months ago was on the decline of free speech on college campuses. We had a situation at Brown University where the police chief of the city of New York was prevented from speaking because students on that campus didn't like the stop and frisk policy, even though it was legal when it had been applied. You can say it's a bad policy. It's a good policy. It doesn't matter. He prevented from speaking. At Swarthmore, the students who wanted to disinvest from oil companies prevented people from speaking. The president and the dean of students were in the meeting where and they did nothing. They did not speak up. Nothing happened to those students. Why did that happen? I think this is related to what's happened in Europe, Milt. I think there is a fundamental loss of confidence in the basic values of the culture, so that people don't want to stand up and say, for example, faculty, I know something, I want to teach it to you, I think this curriculum is what everybody who is an undergraduate should choose from, and if you don't think it, go to another university. But there's not a sense of that. You can't prevent other people from speaking, and I just think that there's a fundamental spinelessness.
What does the decay of religion in the Western world have to do with such phenomena?
I think you all are looking at it from a glass half empty standpoint, and I and many younger people are looking at it from a glass half full standpoint, that they have respect for everyone's viewpoints and don't think that people's policies and what they study and what they talk about should be dictated.
But there's no respect. Where's the respect for the differing opinion? There's no respect for I am Hersey Ali. They disinvited. That's not respect.
Well,
Condi Rice.
Condi Rice. Is that disrespect?
Honor Diaries and the people who
paid
for it. No, we're
talking about Condi Rice.
Yeah, but that's... Oh, well, I think that's completely wrong. I think that's ridiculous that they shouldn't let her
but
speak.
But why did the people who run Rutgers allow that to happen? That's the question Milch is posing.
That is the question. That is the question, and it was fascinating to me because Rutgers is a public university. You know, it's not a private university. It's
right.
a public university.
It's a state university of New Jersey.
It's basically the University of New Jersey.
Right.
And that was fascinating to me, actually, and I think
in
totally
a disgusting
wrong.
Way.
Yeah, absolutely. It, you know, if you don't agree with her, fine.
Are there any adults in charge there?
Are there in most
well,
of the universities?
Well, ask Chris Christie, who's in charge of it.
Kitty, the thing here is... But we hear about tolerance, it's intolerance. I mean,
this
phrase.
And this is the fear of intolerance.
Hold on.
I'm getting to you. I'm going to make your point, Chris.
But it's not the fear. It's actual. The intolerance is actual. But when President Obama says the debate is over, he is saying it's okay to be intolerant of people who disagree with my Barack Obama administration on the issue of climate change. He is saying intolerance is the value.
No, he's saying 97% of the scientists have decided and 97% of anybody who decides this pretty much means the debate is over. But getting back to Europe, because this is something that's very, very frightening to me and I think should be to all of you also. And Chris, you and I have talked about this. The rise of hate parties, whether they're anti-Semitic, anti-Arab, or anti-Jewish. You know, in Hungary now, in Parliament, they're putting Jews on lists again. There's moves to put Jews on lists. The same things in Ukraine, where Ukraine has a lot of problems, but this is one of their bigger ones. All of these, the Holocaust denial here, even in the U.S., there was a school in California that thought it was okay to debate whether the Holocaust happened or not. You know, this...
They don't teach it in English schools.
Actually, they do in almost... They teach the Holocaust and the Rwandan genocide, the Cambodian genocide. They do teach it, but there are... But at the same time, there's this rise of very well-funded people on what I call the hate side of the equation. And the problem of the Internet and the beauty of the Internet... is all of the people on the hate side of the equation, the the Holocaust deniers in England are talking to this guy that shot the people in Kansas last week. They're all talking on the hate side of the equation, and the people on the tolerance side of the equation, the people who are trying to create dialogue, who are trying to say that Jews are equal, aren't talking to
when
one another.
When our students, pro-Israel students, meet on the University of Chicago campus, there are now Palestinian students who shadow them. They have intimidated them at tables and so forth, and anything that happens, there's now a group, so-called Students for Justice in Palestine. Nobody knows who funded it. It appeared everywhere all at once. They've attacked their students in various ways. They disrupt things, but they literally shadow them everywhere.
This is a very
disgusting.
Hold on, friends. This is a very hot topic, but time now grows short. Let me shift on you. Looking to another way of examining the problems of interstate relations and sorting them out for the general good. I offer you another quotation. I won't identify the author at the moment, but what do you make of this? A lot of people think that international relations is like a game of chess. But it's not a game of chess where people sit quietly, thinking out their strategy, taking their time between moves. It's more like a game of billiards with a bunch of balls clustered together. By the way, Chris, you did very well identifying the first quote from Putin. Do you know the source of this one?
No.
Nobody
it's
does?
Awesome quote, but I have no idea.
It's a former American Secretary of State. It's Madeleine Albright.
There you go.
Now, what does she mean? Is international relations more like a game of billiards? I have never played billiards, so I'm a little confused.
You know, I was struck when I lived in England for a time. I had a research position at London School of Economics, just on leave from the University of Chicago, that America loves pool, you know, straight eight ball, that sort of thing. But in England, they love snooker, if
right.
they call it.
Snooker.
They, you play it off of three different sides and so forth. It's very indirect. And my sense is that one of the ways that America gets beat in world politics is that we think roughly one move ahead. I think that what you're seeing, for example, with Putin in Ukraine is a policy of intimidation. He doesn't necessarily have to take the other stuff. He's distracted us now about Crimea. It's a done deal. Nobody's even talking about it. All the focus is on eastern Ukraine. Then there's a focus on whether or not any government in Kiev would be able to stand up to it. So he's got a policy of intimidation, and I'm not at all clear what our policy in response to him. We've been very careful. I'm not trying to be overly critical of the Obama administration for a careful policy, but I don't think it's been a very strong policy, and my sense against China and all the rest is that we just don't think very far ahead. We don't have any strategy.
Charles, I mentioned earlier that you're working on a new book,
and
you've told me privately something of the viewpoint you're developing. It's quite relevant just where we are right now for me to ask you, what's the basic thesis of the new book?
The basic thesis is that almost all studies of international politics begin with the idea that the basic actors of states and the states face external threats, and the politics of the world is organized around states as they deal with external threats. I think that's correct, but it's missing half the story. States themselves are actually controlled by domestic regimes, so that the Putin regime controls the Russian state. The regime in Japan is different than the regime of Imperial Japan. It's still Japan, but it's not. And there are two things that you can look at about the regimes that control states. One is, do they face internal threats? We talked about China, for example. If you were to look at Bashar al-Assad in Syria and ask, why is he allied with Iran? It has nothing to do with an external threat.
It has to do with an
internal threat to his regime. The second thing is that large powers, both regional powers like China and global powers like the United States and earlier the Soviet Union, have purposes that they pursue in the world, and those purposes are, in a sense, suffused with the characteristics of that regime, so that Russia, the USSR, didn't pursue the same kind of policies in the world that the United States did, and the policies that the fascists pursued, both in Japan and in Germany, were suffused by that regime. So that's the basic story, and I call it dual politic because they're looking both outward and inward.
A related angle in all of this, would you agree, is domestic politics and the ways in which the foreign policy innovations you introduce may tend to contribute to your political gain within your own nation.
Yes. There's a wag the dog of policy. There are interest groups and all the rest. The problem that you have if you go all the way down to the level of who are the environmentalists and how do they stack up against the unions or against the oil companies or something like that, is you've got one country's foreign policy. Now we have to go to all the six other countries. There are 60 other countries they're interacting with and look deeply inside them. So I wanted to see if I could simplify that and say that regimes in countries, we could take one step inside the boundaries of the billiard ball states, to go back to your billiard ball analogies, and see if we could get some purchase.
Did you, by the way, complete the assignment that I gave you to read my essay of some years ago, Attitude und Veränderung in Außenpolitik in der Ära des Kalten Krieges?
Well, I have at least asked Google to translate that.
Well, and I can translate it for you.
I do have the book, and I found
it's Jim Rosenau.
It's Jim Rosenau, who is still around. Yeah. And I do have the book, and I immediately remember the colors of the book, red and black.
Perhaps so. That translated is Attitude Change and Foreign Policy in the Era of the Cold War. The major thesis
Milton,
developed there was...
I am so glad you spoke German. I was going to criticize you at the end of this podcast
for
having gone through two podcasts with you with no German. I had gotten Greek in the first podcast, but no German, and
you got
me
there.
Okay.
So I think you're absolutely right, Charles, and I think if you look at Russia and Ukraine today, what's happening is exactly what you're talking about, because the more Putin is pushing on Ukraine from the outside, the more the parties within Ukraine who had been acting separately but were all sort of anti-government parties are now all talking to one another and working together and figuring out a way where they can agree on what they're going to agree on and unite against the party that was formerly in power. And they might not have done that and might not have cooperated and might not have talked to one another without the pressure of Putin from the outside.
Christopher?
I have to say, since we're using Ukraine. I kind of want to get to Syria and Iran. And I want to say that I think a dominant feature of this period since President Obama came in with an orientation to multilateralism and an orientation to international organizations and to a sense of the rule of public international law, okay? So he comes in this way. And I think for lack of better, you know, so as to not to substitute political rhetoric, I think he honestly sort of believed in that stuff at some level. I think he thought if you promote this stuff and if you are reacting to a George Bush, then you're going to find some moral or persuasive influence in this stuff. And he was rewarded with the Nobel Prize 14 minutes after becoming president.
For distinguished services and not being George Bush.
There you go. And what we've seen in the 5 years since then, I think, with all respect to the president, is that he was completely wrong. And what you see time and time again, whether it is Putin who can say in the New York Times op-ed, the rule of law is the rule of law, or whether it's Tehran or whether it's Bashar al-Assad, you go around the world and what you find is that the international organizations and the rule of public international law remains an element in the mix of relations between states, but it is not the dispositive element.
A question about American political performance with regard to foreign affairs, namely John Kerry. He's been Secretary of State for a while now. He seems to be getting pretty bad press. Does he deserve bad press?
Sure. Sure he does.
Why?
Well, for one thing, he rubbed Israel's nose in a Palestinian desire to make Israel the wrong party in the, you know, a phony attempt, an utterly phony attempt. I mean, an embarrassingly phony attempt to have something called peace talks. I mean, the reason I hit on that, of course, Israel is a close ally, and we care deeply for the independence and integrity of the state of Israel. But more importantly, to your question of John Kerry, he chose to make that a defining characteristic of his tenure. He got to be the hand came down from taking the oath of office as Secretary of State, and the feet got on the airplane to go to the Middle East. And I think he has nothing to show for that.
And his tenure isn't over yet. And there's talks going on, and people are talking. And it's awfully, in foreign policy particularly, it's awfully hard to prove a negative. But there are a lot of situations where we could, in the last 2 years, in the last 5 years, where we could have been involved in more violence and have started another war, and we didn't. And that's a harder thing for history to judge.
So let me say three things about American foreign policy. The first is to agree with Chris's point about Barack Obama's general perspective. It was a kind of grand strategy of multilateralism, a hand reached out to our adversaries, and so forth. That strategy has not succeeded anywhere. I have asked a lot of people in fairly senior positions, can somebody name a triumph in foreign policy of this administration? And you might hear one thing occasionally in a half-hearted way, but basically they're very it's failed. What strikes me about it is that the Obama administration has not come up with a replacement. People fail all the time. Businesses have strategies. When those strategies fail, you pick a different strategy. We don't have one. So that's item one. Item two is that Kerry is executing, I think, largely the Obama foreign policy. But he looked around the Middle East with a huge war in Syria, with Libya in absolute chaos, with Iran about to develop nuclear capabilities, and said, with no basis in fact, you know, I think I'll concentrate on the Israel-Palestine issue, when it was not particularly promising at the very outset. In other words, what outside powers can do is, if the two parties to an agreement are would like to make the agreement and need some reassurance or additional incentives, we can help, but we cannot force an agreement. He made fundamental mistakes.
We approach the end of the available time. Last query. Alfred Lord Tennyson, in his great poem Locksley Hall, looks forward into the near future, or maybe it's the distant future, and imagines a time when the war drums throb no longer, and the battle flags are furled in the Parliament of Man, the Federation of the World. Do we still think in terms of universal government?
I'm going to go back to, I said that the threats are chaos and terrorism. Obama went there and killed Osama bin Laden, has dismantled al-Qaeda, because those are where most of the threats are coming from. Iran hasn't been, you know, is a problem, but hasn't been an explosion. I think he's trying to get there by going after the
Well, that's your level of a point. But where do you stand with regard to Tennyson's vision?
I think that we're coming very close to a parliament of man among the advanced, stable, constitutional democracies. And abutting them is a world of hurt.
Yeah, I think we're at a bellum omne contra omnes.
I think that the two big issues, well, are China and the Islamic world, but I would differentiate between Iran and this chaos. I'm not as optimistic as you are, Kitty, about the way that we've handled al-Qaeda. I see it franchising all over the place, and I see a lot of the people who are fighting in Syria with American or British passports or French passports coming back and just being a world of hurt.
With that, my friends, we close necessarily with my warm thanks for an excellent conversation.